This is Kevin Kosar of AlcoholReviews.com. I'm here today with Todd Kleiman, author of the new book, The Wild Vine, A Forgotten Grape and the Untold Story of American Wine. Todd's a very busy guy. He's the food and wine editor at The Washingtonian, and The Wild Vine has been receiving a lot of media attention, and so he's been barnstorming the nation, promoting the book, and wowing audiences. So we're very lucky to have Todd here for a short interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Now, Todd, when did you first start writing about food and drink, and what got you started?
I started writing about food probably about, I first did a piece about a restaurateur. I think that was 1999, something like that, and I'd never written about food before that. I mean, you know, except in high school. But I traveled a lot, built my trips around eating. I've never seen myself as a foodie because I like food at all ends of the spectrum. But I've always loved the culture of food and the adventure of seeking out food. And I'd never thought to write about it. Nowadays, I mean, I get letters from, or emails from teenagers, 13, 14 years old, and they want to become food critics, which is really astonishing, I think. I was not like that. I never really imagined that this was something that you would, do for a living. But I started writing a column for the Washington City paper when I noticed that the food columnist apparently had left. And I thought, well, I've done a slew of book reviews, and I thought it was comparable. Of course, little did I know it's a very, very, very different model, and it's a whole different kind of critical model. But I loved it, and did that freelance. When the column came open, they conducted a I don't know if it was a national search, but it was a pretty broad search, and I won, and then did the column for a couple of years, and then moved on to Washingtonian about 5 years ago after I won a James Beard Award for that column. So I've been doing this since about 2001 pretty steadily.
Okay. The Wild Vine, how long did it take you to write The Wild Vine? When did you get started on it?
Well, it's a really good question because I don't really know when to pinpoint anything with this. It was a story that I think I resisted plunging into for the longest time. I first tried a Norton, I would say about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was this dinner party that was kind of. It wasn't really even a dinner party. It was a dinner. It was thrown together in the aftermath of this hurricane, and power had been out in this area where I lived for about 4 or 5 days. And so people were just kind of at wit's end trying to kind of entertain themselves. And it was really kind of like a pre-modern existence for a while. And at this party, somebody had a Norton, and I had never heard of Norton. I had a lot of California wines, Oregon wines, Washington wines, wines from Europe. And when I first tried this, I thought, what the hell? Because it was so different, and I had no real understanding of how to think about it or describe it. It was just very, very strange. It had fruitiness. But it was also big. It was sort of very high acidity, I could tell, and yet it was there was some element in there. There was some kind of wild streak to it that didn't kind of square with wines that were like it. It was just an odd bird, and I liked that about it. I thought it was interesting. There are people who taste that for the first time and hate it. Of course, there are people who taste that for the first time and love it. I didn't know at the time that Norton inspired such such extreme extreme reactions. And of course, if I did, I would have loved it even more. I mean, I say in the book that Norton is the wine of love and hate and nothing in between. And I'm attracted to that. I'm attracted to that notion. But I essentially went in search of this bottle, and I thought, you know, I was writing a column at the time, and I thought, you know, maybe this would make an interesting column. And I went in search of the bottle, and that led me to a winery, which led me to the woman who owned the winery and was, you know, in a sense, the vendor. And it was interesting to me because you don't see a lot of women in the world of wine who are, I mean, if they own wineries, they tend to be very removed from the operation. Here was somebody who was very, very hands-on, you know, making it, championing it, you know, selling it. It was kind of almost like a one-man band, although, of course, she had a lot of help. And so I got to know her a little bit and found her to be enormously interesting. And she was earthy and funny and this real character. I mean, somebody who just impresses you right off with how much herself she is. I've always liked that about people. And so I was attracted to that. I thought that, you know, here was somebody that I liked right from the beginning and wanted to know more about. But I still was not thinking anything larger than a column, and I wasn't even really sort of set on a column either. I just didn't know. I was sort of just pursuing an interest. And when I met her, I mean, she opened up this entire world of the Norton and the Norton history and the Norton story, and it was all so interesting. And I thought, well, this is very interesting. It's way too much for a column, and there's way too much I would need to know just to understand this. And I kind of resisted because, you know, I like wine. I love drinking wine. I love the idea of wine kind of knitting people together at a table or where have you. But I never wanted to become sort of immersed in wine as something to study and something to research. When I was learning about wine as a casual drinker, I resisted taking courses. I resisted going to tastings and learning the vocabulary of wine tastings. That, you know, the tar and lead pencil and blackberry and notes of currant. I just resisted that. And so I think there was an element of me that just resisted this process because it would be getting into wine in a way that I didn't want to. But I found myself kind of working on this on the margins, and every time I would kind of put it out of my head, I would kind of come back to it a little bit. And I'd spend time, you know, poking into some of the Norton story, which was difficult because so much of it has either not been recorded or it's been lost, or it just, you know, simply doesn't exist. And it was a number of months, and it was maybe 7-8 months after this that I realized, you know, I'm actually researching this. I'm researching this without admitting to myself that I'm doing research. Which is actually the best way. And at that point, I thought, you know, let's just own up to what we're doing here, and we're in this. We care about this. And it was at that point I went to this woman, Jenny McLeod, and said, you know, I'd like to learn more, and you know, I need a guide, you know. And she became, I guess you could say, a teacher. You know, my teacher in the Norton story. It became somebody who guided me to sources and kind of created a path for me to follow. And it was essentially following her path, the path she had taken to learn about the Norton and to become a Nortonian, which I didn't know what that, I had no idea what that meant at the time. The book is in some way the process of figuring that out. But, you know, followed her footsteps, spent time in certain libraries, went to Charlottesville and chased down the Jefferson connection here and went out to Missouri and spent time in some of the small towns in Missouri that made up the so much of the Norton story in the mid-19th century. And, you know, Jenny became a kind of a seminar leader, a guru, in really kind of directing my research. And in the process, I got to know Jenny better. And at a certain point along that way, I learned that Jenny's story was an amazing story, and that as much as I liked and admired her when I first met her, enough to want to become her friend, her story took on deeper significance for me, deeper resonance for me, because I learned that she had been a man. And so that story of her transformation initially threw me, because I thought, well, you know, this is something different. I mean, this is, we have this whole story of the Norton, this lost grape, and this chapter that nobody knows in American history. And then we have, you know, this woman and her personal story, and these things initially seem to be these divergent strands. But, you know, I at that point, I wasn't researching much anymore, and I really was just trying to get to know Jenny more and learn more about Jenny, and I was really thrown for a good time trying to figure out what really I was working on at this point. The book really became about seeing how these two threads connected, and they really do, and the way they connect is through the Norton, and Jenny is the Norton incarnate. Jenny is this thing that is so singular that it can't be reduced to any one thing else. Just as the Norton is this grape that makes this wine that tastes like nothing else. It's not a Merlot, it's not a Cabernet. It doesn't resemble those in any real way. And neither does Jenny. And she had said something to me fairly early on, before I knew any of this. She said that it was her determination in this new chapter of life. And at the time, of course, I thought that was simply to leave behind a tech business and become a vintner. And she said, I don't want to make the world's 350th best Merlot. You know, I want to make the world's best Norton. And at the time, I thought, well, that's, you know, it's a great notion. It's just, you know, a very determined notion. And it was about two and a half years maybe before I realized what really she was saying. And what she was saying was, you know, the Norton is me, and I want to be as me as I can be. The Norton is a singular thing. I want to be the singular thing, and in becoming more fully herself by going through this process and all these surgeries and all this transformation, she was becoming as fully realized as she could be, and she was becoming literally the Norton. And so the Norton is this stubborn, wild, earthy thing that's not like anything else, and that's Jenny. And so these things, you know, connected. So the book is really it's using Jenny's story and using the Norton story to explore this this kind of quality of outsiderness and singularity and difference, connecting them. And the book is structured as a search, you know, my search as narrator and as character to understand Jenny and Jenny's journey and Jenny's, you know, search to find herself and connect with Dr. Norton, this man who gives his name to the grape, concocts the grape in the early 19th century in Richmond in the 1820s, and her search to connect with him. She feels this deep kind of spiritual kinship with him. So it's her quest to connect with him. It's my quest to understand her quest. And then the you know, the backdrop is 200 years of American history as seen through the story of the people who don't fit, the bootleggers, the immigrants, this doctor who, Dr. Norton, who is a part of antebellum Richmond society, but not really. He's really on the margins of that. He's very much outcast in this world. Actually, he's living in Richmond around the same time that Edgar Allan Poe is, and they share a lot of commonalities in their loneliness and melancholy. And you know, and so the book is this exploration of these these misfits, you know, a transsexual, immigrants, bootleggers, people who come to this wine with no nobility, no prestige. In the case of some of the immigrants in Missouri in the mid-19th century, no education, no learning at all. And there's one man who becomes a seminal figure in American wine, George Huisman, who has, I think, a third or fourth grade education, and becomes a writer of monographs and becomes a scholar, and all of this by kind of raising himself up to become a figure of renown. So that's the process, and it very much evolved over about 4 or 5 years, and it was, as I said, it was initially this process of resisting, and then it was plunging into it, and then it was this sense of being lost in the woods because Jenny's story seems so divergent from the Norton story, and I realized it's not divergent at all. It's part and parcel, and the Norton story can't really be fully told or told with any kind of real resonance without her. And I didn't really want to write a book that's just, you know, the biography of a grape or just the story of a grape. And I at a certain point, I think I knew that the Norton had a great structure to it, because here's this thing that comes out of nowhere, you know, and scales the heights and becomes this award-winning wine in the 1870s, wins a gold medal, plunges to oblivion with the advent of Prohibition, and then is made, you know, something of a comeback. So it's this sort of three-part structure that's built into the Norton story. But it wasn't until I met Jenny, well, you know, really got to know Jenny and got to know who Jenny was and saw Jenny as this way of embodying the story and as sort of the metaphor for the story, that just really took root in my imagination and became a book. I didn't really just want to write a straight history of the Norton. So this book is a hybrid, just like the Norton. It's memoir and history, it's biography and travelogue, and all these things braided together to use this the story of this grape to get at something larger in America and in the American character. And of course, now I've rambled on and on and on, Kevin, and I'm sorry about that, but yeah, that's really the process, and that's how the book came to be.
No, it's good. That's good. That's good. You, I mean, you explained that this is not just your typical, here's a grape, here's where it's been grown, here's what it's been used for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This book is a different type of animal. It's an exploration. It's a looking forward, a looking backwards. And there are a lot of things going on in the theme of alienation or being an outsider is recurrent. Daniel Norton, obviously, as you described, the man behind the Norton grape was estranged. Maybe there are class issues, personality issues, other things going on.
Yeah.
Jenny's story, Jenny McLeod of Chrysalis, she, the story is complex and bending, involving gender identity issues. And then there's this grape itself, which was not simply something that was indigenous to the Americas, growing wild and the settlers happened upon it, but actually emerged as kind of a solution to an early American wine problem. You mentioned it was a hybrid.
Right. This is a concocted grape. Daniel Norton did what nobody had been able to do for 200 years, and you know that is even more impressive when you consider that, in large part, I don't want to overstate it, but to a good degree, the Jamestown project was in order to create a wine colony, a self-sustaining wine colony. For the English crown, they were determined to get out from under the French when it came to wine, and from the Spanish, and the idea of a self-sustaining wine colony was very, very attractive. But they failed, and they failed because they lacked an understanding of the new world and what that meant, and that you can't simply grow the same things that you grow in Europe because the climate is different, the soil is different. Ironically, and the notion of terroir is explored in many ways throughout the book. It's I sort of use terroir as this prism to kind of look at all the different ways that word is meaningful. But it's interesting to me that the notion of terroir is so important in Europe and in European winemaking, and it's absolutely ignored here in the colonies. Well, in Virginia before there are the colonies, but the idea is simply not regarded with any great feeling. They try to just simply take what was done in Europe and hope that it'll take root in the new world. And so for 4 or 5 decades after the arrival in 1607, they try this, and they fail miserably. The early reports about winemaking are that when wine is produced, it has the odor of wet dog, not attractive. Yeah. Over the periods the 18th century, just after this time when the colonists kind of move on to other things that might succeed, various other people come along and take up the challenge, and eventually Thomas Jefferson comes along and says, I'm going to give this a go, and I love wine, I care about wine, and he tries, and he's really determined to get behind a grape, to make a grape a kind of a project, something that's preferably native, and will grow and make good wine. But even failing that, any kind of grape that will grow well in the New World and give America its noble grape, or it's one grape that that America will be known for, and that search occupies him for about 50 years, and he tries to make wine for 50 years at Monticello. He fails. He brings in all sorts of help from Europe, and he's of course traveled widely throughout the wine regions of France, taking notes and speaking to experts. And what's interesting is, he repeats the same failures essentially as the colonists at Jamestown. Everybody's trying to do what was done in Europe, and it just won't work. The very things that are prized, that sense of place, that sense of character that the soil imparts, or the combination of the soil and the air, is not really recognized, not really given its due here. And so here you have Daniel Norton living really in the shadow of Thomas Jefferson, and Norton is a nobody, according to capital H history. But Norton figures out what to do, and he's a melancholic, and that's an awful thing to be when you lose your wife and your child, and he's plunged into the depths, and he's on the verge of suicide. When he realizes that one of the experiments he's been working on in his garden outside of Richmond has worked, and that was to take these two grape plants, one a European grape plant, one a native grape plant, hybridize them. And then what I love is that there's this unknown element in the Norton DNA, because he did this on purpose. This was a purposeful experiment, but he also left room for chance, and I don't know why he did that, but I think when you're experimenting as he was, and I sort of think what he was doing was throwing up as many darts against the board as he could, and just seeing what might work. In this case, this experiment you know, the hybridization of the European and the American plants succeeded, and some other element wound up in the mix, because the hybridization was covered, but it wasn't, you know, capped. The cover blew off, and the grape was, or this hybrid was again pollinated by probably by a bird carrying something from another plant. Scientists really don't know, and there's been some attempt to kind of figure out the exact you know, parentage of the Norton. We do know that it's part Europe, it's part America, and it's part mystery. And I love that, because I think they're, you know, to me the Norton is quintessentially American. It's the gumbo of grapes, because it's a little America, it's a little old world, it's a little new world, and then there's this element that we don't know. So many Americans, if you ask them about their lineage, will say, well, I'm part Scottish, I'm part Irish, I'm part Indian, and then we don't really know what all the rest is.
Yeah.
And that's the Norton. The Norton is, you know, this known thing that combines these two worlds and then the unknown. And he succeeded with that, the Norton became the foundation for American viticulture in the 19th century. Very, very quickly, if you think about it, this creation and the propagation of this grape, within a quarter century, I mean, it became really the basis for so much of the winemaking in America, because it was the one grape that could withstand in Virginia especially, it could withstand the climate in the wintertime and also in the summertime. You know, you had this frost, these frosts that would come in the winter. It was a very capricious winter climate, and then the summer you have a lot of humidity. Very, very different conditions from what you find in the European countries. And so the Norton could succeed. The Norton was capable of withstanding all these things and still making a good drinkable wine. And not only good and drinkable, but in some cases great. The early reports, and I guess culminating in the report from the some of these competitions in the 1870s, there was a judge who is a character in the book, is an amazing figure, Henry Vizzitelli. Vizzitelli proclaims Norton to be comparable to, in some cases, a good Bordeaux, and you know, with age will kind of take on the properties of a good Bordeaux, and he believes, this is 1870, so this is about 50 years after the Norton has been put in, you know, sent into the marketplace. In about 50 years, the Norton has already established itself as being a great grape, and experts in Europe think that it will be, you know, the basis of an American viticulture that will be something that will stand toe-to-toe with the best of the world. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing to think of, because nobody now knows the first thing about Norton. I didn't know the first thing about Norton when I first had that sip 5 years ago.
Yeah, just going back to some of the themes you explore, I mean, one of the things that was really striking to me is the kind of parallels in the mistakes, the early mistakes. The English government comes over here and tries to establish an extension of English government. Early settlers come over here and try to establish an extension of European winemaking, and guess what? It didn't take root. I mean, they struggled, and in order to succeed, they had to kind of hybridize old world and new world in order to work something up. And when they did that, there was a sudden explosion of success. I mean, the American government went from this hapless thing to something of real significance in a short time, and the Norton did also. And there was also this, you know, it kind of struck me as humorous. I don't know if you intended it as so, but, you know, Jefferson and the founding fathers, you know, right now we hold them up in the pantheon and all that, associate them with white marble columns and so forth. But they were the scrappy underdogs,
right,
in the fight against the Crown. And you know, a lot of people didn't think there was any chance. They were the uppity ones. They're the ones who wanted to break away from the old way. But after that happens and the government gets up and running, Jefferson and others become the in-crowd. They become the kind of regnant natural aristocracy. And so here we have Jefferson, you know, a huge figure and a man who has resources beyond what most anybody else in this new country had, and he can't solve this great puzzle. He can't figure out the wine thing. And so what happens? An underdog, a nobody, a melancholic on the edge of society suddenly solves the problem.
That's very much, and to me, that's a quintessential American thing. It's going to be the scrappy outsider always who solves the problem. I don't want to get into it, you know, popular culture necessarily, but I mean, you see that with some of the films that are out now. Although I have a lot of problems with it, the Social Network that's out. I mean, I don't think it's the movie that a lot of the critics think, but in any case, it is that sense of the scrappy outsider thinking differently, who solves the riddle or who comes up with an answer that has eluded the dominant culture. But yeah, I mean, this is what's so interesting about this time. You were talking about this sort of very 19th century notion of the hybrid, and here you have the Norton's heyday is 1870s, and so this time period, so interesting culturally, because you have Walt Whitman is writing a new kind of poem. It's not a European poem. It's not a poem that people in Europe are going to understand or embrace. It departs, you know, from those models. And you have Twain is writing a new kind of novel, the vernacular novel. And these things both have their roots in Europe, but they are fundamentally different. And they're the admixture of old world and new world. And you've got, with what will become jazz, you've got the first stirrings of that. You have a music that is part old world, part new world.
Yeah.
And the Norton is very much a product of its time in that sense. It's very much one of these cultural expressions that the European palate cannot understand. The Norton is the Norton is a very rugged taste. It really is. I see it as a line of Whitman. I see it as a chapter from Twain, or some of the kind of early body, more raucous jazz. It's not trying to be anything other than itself, and what that means, that itselfness is this, you know, crazy mixture. And I think that's a wonderful thing, regardless of whether it's a wine suited to people's taste. I think the fact that it so expresses something of this of what this country is, I think is valuable. And what's interesting to me is that we know Twain, we know Whitman, we know jazz, and the Norton has been largely forgotten. And all those three things were allowed their natural course of development.
What happened to the Norton? I mean, you mentioned that it won a medal in the 1873 Vienna Universal Exhibition. I mean, it was at the pinnacle. A real culture had developed around it. And now, a mere 130 years later, people have no clue.
No clue. And what we also have in the 1870s, it's not only really kind of the high point of American cultural expression of the 19th century, but, you know, in some ways you could argue that's the foundation for what emerges in the early part of the 20th century. The 1870s are also a time of great peril in Europe, European winemaking. France is on the verge of ruin because of phylloxera, and in France at this time, the important people in wine, and of course, wine is so so central to the character of the country, to the identity of these people. The important people are looking to America to possibly repopulate the vineyards, because this louse is destroying everything, and eventually the solution is arrived at, which is to graft American rootstocks onto to French vines. But before that, the plan B, as it were, is to go with American vines, and the French are very intrigued by the Norton. The Norton's been winning awards in the 1870s, and it's capturing people's attention, and the French kind of like it, particularly those who were familiar with the wines of the Languedoc, which are more the earthy, kind of more rugged wines anyway. And so this idea of repopulating the vineyards of France with things like Norton and other wines at the time, Clinton and Ivy and Herbemont, I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think that the French would capitulate like that, but they were desperate. And that period is just so interesting. And what happens is France rises again, and America just collapses. The Norton is undone by a number of things, one of which is that the Transcontinental Railroad opens up, and California, which to this point has been a cipher. I mean, a lot of the wine critics of the day were speculating that California would never emerge despite its, very obvious gifts. But of course it does emerge, and refrigeration comes in, and that helps. And then comes Prohibition, and Prohibition just destroys everything that's been built with the Norton. Prohibition lasts 13 years, but we're still living with the effects of it. And winemaking in Virginia and Missouri is slow to respond after repeal. California does emerge, and emerges very quickly, and in part because of some of the know-how, some of the know-how from Missouri goes west. What's hard to understand is that Virginia and Missouri were the heart of American winemaking 150 years ago, 100 years ago, and we have no sense of that now. I think if you had not had Prohibition, you'd not had that rupture, and it's a rupture more than 13 years. It really, for all intents and purposes, it's a rupture of about 45, 50 years in Missouri, and more than that in Virginia, maybe 70. But if you hadn't had that rupture, you would have in the Norton a grape that was being made continuously in America wine made from a grape that would have gone back, would go back 150 years. That's something. California doesn't have that. You see some of the vines in Missouri. A lot of them have been destroyed in Virginia, and most of them have been destroyed in Missouri. These are new Norton vines. They're 20, 30, 35, 40 years old. But there are a couple vines left over, and they go back to pre-Civil War. Pre-Civil War Missouri. So you're talking about 1850s, early 1860s. These vines are so gnarled and nutty, and I mean they're like tree stumps. Older vines tend to make better wines, and I think if not for this big gap, California would still be a power, and I think that was inevitable. I don't know if critics in the day could see it, but I think its dominance was pretty inevitable. But I do think that if there hadn't been Prohibition, California would be strong, but Virginia and Missouri, that latitude, that terroir, if you will, would be regarded as kind of noble country today. And I think that area would be given its due. And I think that you would still have California, but you would have people drinking these wines because they embodied something. There was a rich history there, and that even if people weren't necessarily crazy about the wines, they would appreciate the character and the story behind it. And I think also that it also bears saying that when you drink a Norton today, you're drinking something that really ought to be marked with an asterisk, because we don't really know what a Norton would taste like. A Norton that had developed along its natural course. It'd be really interesting to drink a Norton that had a vine that went back that far. We'll never know. But I think that potential would certainly be there for something really, really wonderful. I don't think the Norton would ever be, I mean, if, you know, when California comes in, it kind of changes taste in America. But I do think that there would be a wider palette of flavor, if you will, in America with regard to wine. I think we have a very kind of left coast palette of flavors and a style of winemaking. It's changing. There's wine being made in really every state now, and East Coast wines are starting to attract some, you know, real attention. And I think it's diversifying that a little bit. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think it's a good thing to have a wide variety of styles, and that's what great wine making cultures have. In France, you have a wide variety of styles within a very small country. Same with Spain, same with Italy. And there's this allowance or an acceptance of the idea that there are rugged wines, there are earthy wines, there are table wines, and not just, you know, the trophy wine, the wine to collect, or the wine to sit by the fireplace.
That's the scenario envisioned, had it not been for Prohibition and other factors kind of toppling Norton down, is an interesting one. A grape produced by an outsider, cultivated largely by those outside the kind of Anglo mainstream, Germans and others in Missouri, suddenly over time, or developing over time and becoming the regnant noble grape of the land, and California ending up being more of the kind of scrappy newcomer. There's a certain irony in that possibility, if that had played out that way. The Norton grape, one gets the impression from your book, is having a rebirth. Obviously, the chrysalis and the imagery of what Jenny's story and her tireless work on this. What future do you see for it? Does the Norton grape have much of a future? Is it going to stay a curiosity? Do you know, is more of it being planted, or more wineries considering bringing it to market? Or is it just, you know, the economics don't work out? It's too difficult to work with? People are afraid.
Well, it's a really good question. And it's interesting. Since the book has been out, I mean, I've been hearing from people. I know Jenny has been hearing from people. There are people in California now who've talked to her and written to me and said that they want to, you know, experiment with growing the Norton out there. I think that's great. I think that what they're going to find is that Northern California is not a great terroir for Norton. Norton is a grape that really needs to be in its sweet spot, and that's Virginia and Missouri. I know a lot of I don't want to say a lot, but there are a number of restaurants now adding Norton to their wine list as a result of the book. I think I saw a bakery in Alexandria, just outside Washington D.C., that was they made Norton marshmallows. So I mean, there's been this sort of fascination, I think, in this Washington D.C. Virginia area with all things Norton. I think that's a good thing. But the larger question is, you know, does this have a real future? And I think it does. I don't think, though, that the Norton is going to ever reach the heights that it reached in the 19th century. And to me, that's sort of poignant because I think this was poised at one time to be, you know, the grape, the thing that America is known for. You know, and here you have the 1870s, and Norton is at its pinnacle, and this is a full 100 years before people now proclaim American winemaking to have begun with the Judgment of Paris tasting in the 1976. But the Norton story really is the story of American winemaking, and I think Daniel Norton is really the father of it. But I think, you know, Norton is being grown in just under or just around 24 states now. That's a pretty good number. I just don't think that the way things have developed that people have a real understanding for how to see it. The taste, as I said, the taste is very unusual. And if it's not made well, you know, it can be particularly off-putting for people. And even if it is, there are a lot of people who will never like it. And I think that's a lot to do with conditioning. I think it has a lot to do with culture. And I think our culture, our wine culture, is one that has been very, very, very influenced by California, and so these tastes are seen as the benchmark for what wine should be, and of course we know what a European wine should be. This is sort of a writ large of what I experienced when I first tasted Norton. I didn't know what the hell I was drinking. I was curious about it, and I have a natural affinity for the oddball or the thing that doesn't fit, or you know, the outsider in any walk of life. And so I was intrigued by this grape that didn't taste like anything, this wine that didn't taste like anything. But I mean, most people are just thinking, well, is this going to go with a steak, or you know, can I open this with a pasta, or do I want to sip this with some friends at a party? And Norton is not that kind of wine, and it's going to frustrate people who are going to come to it with certainties, and I just don't think it can ever become what it was destined to become if it hadn't fallen off track. I think it does have a future in a number of states, and Missouri is one of them. It's the native grape of Missouri. Riedel, which makes those wonderful wine glasses, has made a Norton wine glass.
Oh, no kidding.
It's an interesting glass because the glass tells you how crazy a grape this is. The glass is has a wide bowl, just as you would see for a Cabernet, and then it tapers very dramatically at the top. Similar to what you might find for a Muscadet, or some kind of other dessert wine or something with high acidity, maybe a Riesling. And the glass just captures that crazy identity of this thing that has it's big and ripe and bold. It's a big wine, but it's got a lot of acidity, and it has, I don't know if it has the acidity of a white wine, but it has much more acidity than any red wine I can think of. Actually, not to get too far off course, but it's one reason why I think the Norton makes such a great Thanksgiving wine, because it's red, so it's going to go with a lot of the turkey and some of the gravies and things like that that are part of the meal. But then you have the acidity cut through all that starchy richness and cream and all the other parts of the meal that just make you so moji after a while. And of course, Norton is a great game wine. Anything, like a wild turkey, it's going to be superb with. But back to the point, I don't think that Norton really is going to really develop as more than just a I think it'll be more than a curiosity, and I think it now is no longer a kind of a footnote, and I think that's a wonderful thing, an important thing.
I wonder what little exploration I've done of Norton's is that maybe this is something that is really going to, for the time being, sell to the sort of crowd who buys port. These are folks who have an interest in history. They have a patience, so they're willing to let the bottle lie for a while and develop. And they also, the Nortons I've seen are not at the $6, $8, $10 price point. They're right. $20 some bucks. And so for the time being, that's just the way the economics of it are going to work. And I think there's probably, it's also the case, as you've indicated, that there's a certain profile when it comes to red wine that Americans tend to think of, and this doesn't fit in that profile. Something similar happened with whiskey. Prohibition basically helped people forget what American whiskey tastes like, and they got used to drinking bootleg stuff from Canada, which is mostly blended whiskey and is very lightly flavored. And for the longest time after Prohibition, big bold flavored whiskeys were on the margin of society because everybody was drinking Seagram 7, right. Those sorts
and
of things.
Same thing happened in Missouri trying to regenerate itself after Prohibition, after many years after Prohibition. It's one of the sections of the book, but it really is a fascinating chapter because here you have this state that was the heart of winemaking in America. It was winning awards internationally. But there had been a rupture, and there had been a rupture not just of the winemaking, but of the knowledge. Generations had passed, and things had not been passed down and passed on. And so they are now trying to make wine again in the late 1960s, 45 years after Prohibition. And people don't know what wine is supposed to taste like now. And the bootleg wine, which is, they call it in Missouri, homemade wine, and there are winemakers who are still making it. But the homemade wine is watered down to some degree, and it's sweeter, and that's what people are accustomed to. And so the early winemaking efforts, they can't really make serious wine because, one, first of all, they don't really know how anymore. They've got to go back to books, and it's not going to be a tactile kind of experience anymore. But also because if you want to be in business, you have to serve a public, and the public has been changed. The tastes have changed because of Prohibition, and so sweeter, more watery is the fashion. And yeah, it's hard. And I think we can laugh at that, but I think American tastes have changed with regard to understanding Norton. I don't think unless Norton is really tied to this kind of revival of regional and local wine, which is, it's a movement. I think it's a good movement. I think it's a movement that's supporting, terroir on a micro level and saying, Georgia should taste like Georgia, Long Island should taste like Long Island, and there are these differences regionally that are interesting in wine, and each area is going to have its own kind of profile, its own sort of template, and that what that means is that there ought to develop an understanding alongside that these wines will need to be judged differently. It should be good winemaking, but that there should be an understanding on the part of the public, the judges, that these wines are different in character. And I think that's a really good development, and I hope it continues to flourish. I think that what works against that, and Virginia is an interesting example, because in Virginia now, you have grapes like the Norton, which some wineries are embracing and some are not. The wineries are a number of them are simply saying, well, we want to make whatever is going to make good wine. We don't care if it's a a wine that has character, or it's a wine that has a sort of particular stamp on it, as long as it's a good drinkable wine. Well, I mean, that's fine if you're trying to make money. And of course, a winery is in the business of making money, but the sad fact is that the larger picture is that if California and, I'm sorry, if Virginia and Missouri and these other states, these, you know, regional pockets of winemaking are going to really gain a foothold, they're going to have to make wines that taste like only they can make. They're going to have to make wines that are very very much a reflection of their particular terroir. In the book, I talk about the sort of the faction in Virginia, sort of between those who want to produce a drinkable wine at any cost, you know, by whatever means necessary, and the terroirists who really want to work with the grapes that are particularly suited to Virginia. And that's a real battle, and I think that Virginia's future depends on the terroirists winning. And I think the regional wine battle depends on that too. I think you see in Virginia now that there are some wineries that you'll drink a bottle of wine, and it'll be a fine wine, but you'll be hard put to sort of say what the difference is between this and something in California, except for the fact that the price is going to be higher. So
right.
Here you have a wine that tastes like something you've had before, but it's more expensive.
So
and
what's the
I
point?
Don't think that's a model for success.
Yeah, I mean the craft brewing movement did not seek out to knock Budweiser and Miller and others off by simply replicating the sort of lightly flavored lagers. They said, okay, look, this is something that's missing from the marketplace, and they largely concentrated their efforts on doing their own thing, focusing it locally, and developing it from there. And you know, over 30 years, there was an astonishing change. And like I mentioned with whiskey, there was an astonishing change. I mean, big, giant flavored whiskeys now are on the market, and these things were not available just 30 years ago. So
there
could be hope. There could be hope for Norton. There could be hope for a lot of the other unusual grapes. I should close with this question before I forget it, which is the folks who come to alcoholreviews.com often like to walk away or surf off the site with recommendations. You know, which brands of this, that, or the other should they buy? If someone wants to try a Norton wine, which wineries or brands would you recommend?
Well, I would think, you know, I would encourage people to focus on Missouri and Virginia. And in Virginia, Jenny's Winery makes terrific Nortons. Her winery is Chrysalis Vineyards, and it's in Aldie, Virginia, sometimes identified as Middleburg, Virginia. Also in Virginia, making good Norton, there's a winery called Rockbridge, which makes good Norton. A cheaper Norton, I don't know if I would try this as a way of kind of understanding if you like Norton or not, because it's, you have to understand it's a Norton meant to be a table wine Norton, the Norton made by Horton Vineyards in Orange, Virginia. And Dennis Horton is the man who brings the Norton back to Virginia. He ironically grows up two blocks away from the vineyard that makes this historic bottling in 1873. And of course, has no knowledge of this, because by this point, he's growing up in the 50s in Missouri and the small town. He knows nothing of the town's legacy, but the winery has now, for 30 some years at that point, been a mushroom cave, and he used to play there and have this kind of Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn existence playing in these mushroom caves. But he brings it back, and his goal has for a number of years has been to make a Norton as a table wine. So his wine, his Norton, is about $10, $10 or $11. It's about as cheap a Norton as you can find in Virginia. And, you know, it's fine. I wouldn't recommend drinking these wines just, you know, pouring them and sitting on the porch, or pouring them and sitting by the fire and swirling and sniffing and making this, you know, a very, a real study of it. I think Norton is meant for popping open with some food, you know, duck breast. I think the first time I did a pairing with Norton, it was making wild mushroom enchiladas with mole. Norton needs really bold flavors with it, and the charm of it. I think charm is kind of a bad Norton word, but the complexity and the mystery, the character that comes out when you pair it, and it's important also to remember Norton needs, unlike some wines, I mean, I think all wines benefit from being opened a while, but Norton needs about a half an hour. And if you taste it when you first open it, and you taste it half an hour later, it will be one of the biggest differences you notice in an instance of breathing. Norton really benefits from that time to breathe. So those are the ones in Virginia I'd recommend.
Okay.
Rockbridge, Chrysalis, if you're looking for a kind of a table wine, Horton Norton. And in Missouri, some of the finest Nortons are being made at this winery that I was just mentioning, the one that won the Gold Medal in 1873, and again another in 1878 in Paris, and that's Stonehill. Of course, Stonehill, as I said, became a mushroom farm, and its winemaking was interrupted, but they're making some terrific Nortons now, and I think they have a real love of Norton, a real understanding of Norton. They're very complex, almost elegant. I think Jenny's are the same. There's a certain elegance there that you'll see a difference. You'll notice that difference if you first start with something like the Horton Norton, which is the Norton as table wine. So Stonehill makes a Norton, and they also make a Norton under their small label called Cross J. So look for Stonehill Norton or Cross J Norton. I think it sort of depends on the year, but I've really been enjoying the Cross J. 2006. Those are some really fine wines, really interesting wines. And again, I did mention a certain kind of elegance and refinement. They still go better with some food. It's you have to think of them in that sense. That's their old world aspect, and the new world aspect is you're going to get, you know, really, really terrific fruit. In fact, I did a tasting with Jenny a couple years ago in Richmond, and we tasted some wines that had been made in Virginia over the past 20 years, and this was a heritage tasting of these wines. And she entered a Norton in there, and the Norton, I think, was 10 years old, it was 8 years old. You wouldn't have been able to tell this was an 8-year-old wine. I mean, it was still, I don't want to say bursting with fruit, but there was a lot of fruit in that glass. And that's one of the great things about Norton. You get great fruit. And of course, if you age it, proponents like Jenny say that, you know, Norton really can't be fully understood until you age it about 10, 12 years.
Wow.
It really starts to soften. And after about 10, 12 years, it takes on some Bordeaux-y qualities.
Wow. Well, terrific. Terrific. You have been absolutely generous with your time, and we will end the podcast here. I want to thank you for talking about your book, The Wild Vine, and I hope readers will have found this discussion sufficiently interesting that they'll go out and grab a copy. As you explained, it's also going to be coming out in paperback, perhaps, in the next year?
Yeah, it'll be out in paperback in May.
Todd Kleiman, thank you so much.